loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump arrived in the U.K. this morning for trade talks with British Prime Minister Theresa May. He dismissed large-scale protests against his visit and said, quote, "The Brits like me a lot. They agree with me on immigration," unquote. The visit comes 2 days after Trump said that the UK was, quote, "in turmoil." Next, a defiant Peter Stroke told the House Judiciary and Oversight Committees that continued scrutiny of his anti-Trump text messages amounted to, quote, "another victory notch in Vladimir Putin's belt," unquote. The FBI agent said that during the 2016 campaign, he had information that would have derailed Donald Trump's candidacy, but that he never considered releasing it. Then the annual summit of NATO heads of state ended yesterday with President Trump saying that member countries had agreed to increase their defense spending, perhaps even doubling it. But French President Emmanuel Macron was quick to say that the president's statement was untrue. Meanwhile, President Trump reiterated as he was boarding Air Force One that he is, quote, "a very stable genius." And then Israel struck 3 Syrian government targets overnight after an unarmed Syrian drone strayed over Israeli territory. The Syrian media reported that there was material damage, but no casualties. And finally, Monsanto is in court this week because a California landscaper has terminal cancer after using the company's Roundup weed killer for decades. And Monsanto covered up evidence that Roundup is carcinogenic. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to President Trump's visit to the UK. He arrived in the UK this morning for trade talks with British Prime Minister Theresa May. The president dismissed large-scale protests against his visit and said, quote, "The Brits like me a lot. They agree with me on immigration," unquote.
That's because everybody likes him.
And he's a stable genius, but we can talk about that later.
Yeah.
The visit comes 2 days after Trump said that the UK was in turmoil. We are joined from London by legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian George Galloway. George, it's always great to have you.
Thank you. If it's in turmoil, it's partly thanks to his huge motorcade, which just held me up on the way home for an hour. He's overpaid, oversexed, and over here.
So tell us what the mood is like in London. Tell us about these protests.
Well, the protests are going to be quite large. They've moved the schedule in such a way as to make them difficult for him to see. He is right now, having sent his motorcade through Camden, where I work, making my RT show this afternoon. And he flew in on a helicopter, which I saw go overhead. So he's now in Regent's Park, for those who want to follow it closely. And he'll be at Blenheim, the historic palace of Winston Churchill fame, for a dinner with business people this evening at 7 o'clock. But tens of thousands will definitely march against him, maybe in excess of 100,000. They'll be in Trafalgar Square at 2 p.m. tomorrow. But the rest of the schedule is far away from London and helpfully in a castle. In Windsor Castle, where, of course, you can't get near to demonstrate. And then he goes to Scotland to his infamous golf course. He likes golfing, does your president. And there'll be protests there, too. So, he's turned the country upside down, not just physically, because it's a rare state visit that is preceded by a root and branch destabilization attack on the government he's come to visit, and that's what he has done. And if he meets Boris Johnson, the now resigned foreign secretary, during the course of this visit, then he very clearly will be interfering in British domestic and electoral affairs. But the bigger point, guys, is he's over here in Europe acting like Tony Soprano, demanding everyone pony up, double the money on their defense budgets, expanding NATO into new countries, and generally swaggering around like a thug. No one has ever quite seen anything like it before.
I want to ask you specifically about the modalities of this visit. I read in The Guardian today that this is not a state visit, because a state visit would include an address to Parliament and Parliament has said that he is simply persona non grata, and he's not welcome to come into Parliament and address anybody. And so they're calling it a working visit. There were a couple of throwaway lines about talks with Theresa May concerning trade, post-Brexit trade, but nobody really knows what exactly Donald Trump is supposed to be doing over there. Are you hearing anything?
No, and of course he's openly stating, and on this I agree with him, that Theresa May's Brexit proposals are not Brexit at all, and that that casts doubt over whether Britain can make a trade deal with the United States, because under her proposals, will be remain tied to the apron strings of the European Union for the rest of time. So in one way, that makes his visit otios. But he will, I'm sure, double down on his double-up demand that Britain, which struggles to pay 2% of its GNP on defence, that should be doubled to 4%. And I tell you this, there are no takers for that in Britain. Austerity Britain, where people have gone through a full decade of cuts to real wages, massive degradation of public services. The idea that we should double our expenditure on weapons of war is simply preposterous. But that's what he's openly demanding. And he's saying that, well, you know, if you don't, we'll not protect you anymore. So most people's attitude is, I don't want to swear on your show, it's probably going out too early, but go and put that where the sun don't shine, because we don't actually need your protection. Protection from what? Protection from whom? You are the biggest danger to the peace of the world. And the idea that you want money from us to ensure your protection of us is just about the most unpalatable plate anyone was ever served.
That's the voice of George Galloway. George Galloway, legendary anti-war activist, former British parliamentarian, show host of Sputnik on RT television, and currently caught up in a traffic jam because of Donald Trump's visit to the UK. Theresa May, in spite of the fact that Donald Trump will probably throw in soon with Boris Johnson, still acting like the supplicant, promising the lives of young British soldiers to be sent to Afghanistan as a little sort of sop to Donald Trump on the eve of his visit. That can't go down that well with people in the UK.
No, not least because it wasn't even put to Parliament, and it is the custom and practice now, ever since the Iraq War in 2003, that Parliament gets to vote on military deployment overseas, but not on this one. We're sending 400 young British people back to the place where hundreds of them have already perished, defending the poppy fields, and in the forlorn hope that a war in Afghanistan that's been raging now for decades can somehow be won with another 400 British soldiers. But he also announced the expansion of NATO into the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, a wholly unnecessary, a Ruritarian mini-state that hasn't even agreed its name internationally, is now going to be a member of NATO. Macedonia is still in dispute with Greece over whether it can call itself Macedonia or not, but that hasn't stopped the NATO wallahs inviting them into full membership. And the one good thing about all of these controversies, like his attack on Angela Merkel, quite unprecedented and totally berserk just the other day, is that it's raising the question of, why do we want this special relationship? Who would want a special relationship
with the Sopranos?
New Jersey gang leader, yeah. It's rising now as an issue. NATO was a given for decades in this country. Nobody even talked about it. But when I now project the demand that we should be out of NATO, it's finding a new audience, because people don't feel threatened by Russia. They feel threatened by Donald Trump.
Yes, indeed. And And, you know, if the, you know, Obama, George, was the one who got this 2% ball really rolling, insisting, and the NATO member states agreed to it in 2014, that the projected guidelines before, every country must spend 2% of its money on war and death and destruction. That's like a fundamental sort of unifying principle. Yeah. But Obama said, yeah, we're going to make it happen. The agreement was signed. And still the countries didn't do it, except for maybe eight of them, including poor Greece, living under austerity and forced to fork over all that money to the military industrial complex. But if all the countries do it, that will be an aggregate number of about $132 billion annually more than what's being spent now on weapons. And a big part of that money, George, will actually go to American weapons contractors, so-called defense contractors. Kind of a looting of European treasuries for the sake of another welfare subsidy for American military industrial complex.
Well, I couldn't put it better than that. That's why I'm saying the Sopranos, the New Jersey gang, this is a demand for money with menaces. And it's not as if it's going into hundreds of thousands of new soldiers to stand on the wall between us and Russia. It's hundreds of millions, billions, going into the pockets of the very American weapons manufacturers that presumably bankroll the whole American political system in the first place. So as a transfer of wealth from a Europe still sunk in austerity for a non-existent threat to boost the profits of American war manufacturers, this, I mean, even Soprano would have blanched at such thuggery. But I don't know if it's been widely reported there how he behaved towards Angela Merkel.
Oh, yes.
He said that Germany was a prisoner of Russia. And he raised the fact that Merkel herself was born in East Germany in the former German Democratic Republic, implying that she was some kind of sleeper for the KGB. And yet he's about to meet President Putin whilst expanding NATO, demanding a doubling of its resources from the European end. You wonder what this is all about. Is it madness or is there method in the madness? I can't quite work it out yet myself.
Well, we'll see if he accuses Theresa May today of being a stooge of the Russians. We're going to have to leave it there, though. We were joined from London by that legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian and one of my favorite guests, George Galloway. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A defiant Peter Stroke told the House Judiciary and Oversight Committees today that continued scrutiny of his anti-Trump text messages amounted to, quote, another victory notch in Vladimir Putin's belt, unquote. The FBI agent said that during the 2016 campaign, he had information that would have derailed Donald Trump's candidacy, but that he never considered releasing it. We're joined here in the studio by Alex Rubenstein. He's a Sputnik News analyst and journalist, and you can find his work on Twitter at Real Alex Ruby, R-U-B-I. Alex, welcome back.
Thank you.
Alex, this is a combined hearing of the House Judiciary and House Oversight Committees. More than 70 members of Congress are participating. The gallery is packed. Everybody from the press is there. Would you characterize this as a circus?
Yes, it was an absolute mess. Democrats, I don't even think, wanted the hearing to happen in the first place. They were characterizing it as just a means for Republicans to undermine the Mueller probe. And during opening questions from Democrat Jerry Nadler of New York, what was leading on the oversight, I believe, there were signs, poster boards that were held out of every person who has pled guilty in the Mueller probe. And I mean, mind you, none of these people that have pled guilty have done so for collusion with Russia.
Wait a second. So the Democratic members of Congress were actually holding up placards with the pictures of people who have been indicted or pled guilty?
People who have pled guilty, yes. And meanwhile, there was, you know, constant back and forth, constant interruptions between Congressman Trey Gowdy and Peter Strzok, frequent interruptions of him from other Congress members, people who were just like appealing things left and right. Nobody could get a word out half of the time.
We have some audio tape from this hearing. It's that exchange between Gowdy, Trey Gowdy, and Peter Strzok, the FBI lead investigator, for a while at least, both of the Clinton email server from the State Department and the lead investigator then on the Russia probe, which we know started on July 31st, 2016. That would have been 3 days after the Democratic National Convention ended. Let's listen to this exchange.
Agent Strzok, just so the record's clear, because it's been a little while, I didn't ask you the content of those interviews. I didn't ask you the names of who you interviewed. I asked you whether or not you interviewed anyone from July the 31st until August the 8th. And I find it interesting that the FBI will tell us no interviews were conducted before July 31st. That apparently doesn't impact an ongoing probe. But between July 31st and August 8th, it does. Here's the good news. I already know the answer to it. I went and looked at the file. The first interview that I can find is on August the 11th of 2016, which is 11 days after it began, which makes me wonder, on August the 6th, so you hadn't interviewed anyone. You're investigating this alleged Russian collusion with the Trump campaign. You're the lead investigator. You originated the investigation. You're the point of contact. You drafted the document. And here you are before you've interviewed a single solitary witness saying, F Trump. Then that same day, your colleague, Lisa Page, wrote, maybe you're meant to protect the country from that menace. And you responded, I can protect the country at many levels. We're not even a week into an investigation that you originated, approved, were the contact for. You hadn't interviewed a single solitary soul until August 11th. And you're already promising to protect the country from that menace, Donald Trump.
All right, Alex Rubenstein. Again, you have Lisa Page, who was having an affair with Peter Strzok. She's working in the FBI's...
She was the assistant to Deputy Director Andrew McCabe.
Andrew McCabe. And McCabe is, of course, was for a while the acting director of the FBI after James Comey was fired by Donald Trump. But he, too, was helping to oversee the Russian probe of possible collusion between Trump and the Russians. He had also been involved in the Hillary Clinton investigation of the email servers. Also, as the Republicans have pointed out, his wife was running for a state elected office in the state of Virginia, and she received during the same time period $500,000 or so donation from Terry McAuliffe, a key aide to Hillary Clinton. So what did Peter Strzok say in response to Gowdy's questioning that he was already, quote, stopping the menace of Trump? And again, for the audience, we're not friends of Trump here. We're opponents of Trump, but we want to get to the facts. We want to understand what happened.
Well, I mean, throughout the entire hearing, Peter Strzok said as little as possible about the Russia investigation. His line was that he can't speak about it because it's an ongoing investigation. In fact, one time there were FBI lawyers there and there were his personal lawyers there, and Republicans didn't want him to speak to the FBI lawyers, so he had FBI lawyers speak to his lawyers, who then spoke to him so that he knew what he could and couldn't talk about. But one thing that was revealed about Andrew McCabe and his relationship in particular was that after Comey had been fired, on that very day, he said to Lisa Page, he said, we need to open the case we've been waiting on while Andrew McCabe is acting director. He said, while Andy is acting, which means acting director.
And do we have any idea what that is?
We don't really, but clearly it's a criminal case because the investigation had been ongoing for quite some time. So the question becomes, what was the substantive difference between Comey's handling of it and McCabe's handling of it? And why did they think that Andrew McCabe would have been more sympathetic? And there's a clue that we have for that. And that's about 2 weeks after the probe was opened. Lisa Page and Strzok met with each other as well as with Andrew McCabe in his office and discussed taking out an insurance policy against the Trump presidency. So text message says,
we're going to listen to this text message, but the timing is important here. When might this meeting at McCabe's office have taken place?
It's not entirely clear, but the text message that details it was sent just around 2 weeks after the investigation was opened.
So that's, in other words, the second week of August 2016. The investigation began July 31st, presumably.
Exactly. And they hadn't even interviewed any witnesses in the case at that point, according to Trey Gowdy.
With that said, so let's look at this text, actually.
Strzok texted to Page, "I want to believe that the path you threw out for consideration in Andy's office, that's Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, that there's no way he gets elected. This is Trump. But I'm afraid we can't take that risk. It's like taking out an insurance policy in the unlikely event you die before you're 40.
Okay. So anyway, so far, if we summarize the situation, an investigation of Russian collusion with Trump began July 31st. Before that, Christopher Steele, the British intelligence agent, who was first hired by the Republicans, opponents of Trump, and then his resume, his job, his money was picked up by the Democratic Party, by the Hillary Clinton campaign. So he was paid by them to do opposition research, basically, on Trump. Then he goes to the FBI under the direction of James Comey sometime in June or July of 2016. And then at the same time, WikiLeaks starts releasing emails from the Democratic National Committee server, which prove that the Democratic National Committee leadership, Deborah Wasserman Schultz and others, were actually twisting the rules to help Hillary Clinton win the nomination against Bernie Sanders. All that comes out in June and July. It becomes a big issue right before the Democratic Party National Convention, which nominates Clinton, defeats Sanders. That was the end of July, July 26th, 27th, 28th. Again, when did the FBI learn about the hack of the Democratic National Committee, meaning where the emails that went to WikiLeaks that were then released and which the Democrats say was the result of Russia? And again, let's remind the audience, the FBI was told by the Democratic National Committee that they would not give the server to the FBI so it could do a forensic investigation to make sure that the hack actually came from the Russians. They said, no, we don't want to give it to you. But the FBI just took the word of a third party, CrowdStrike. Anyway.
Meanwhile, I mean, we don't even know if it was a hack for sure. It could have been a leak.
Yeah, you're right. That's never really been proven. And there is a school of thought based on the speed with which the information, the data was uploaded, that it could not have been done remotely. It had to have been done in person on a thumb drive.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. But here's the thing about the election is everyone says, well, you know, Comey really screwed Clinton here because, you know, with this press conference that he gave. But here's the thing. Clinton broke several laws and laws pertaining to Freedom of Information Act, things that the public use to understand what their government's doing. And Comey actually jumped through hoops throughout the whole process to absolve Clinton of any criminal wrongdoing. That was detailed in the Office of Inspector General report that he changed the term grossly negligent, which is a criminally liable term, to extremely careless to characterize her handling of the emails. So while everybody is saying that Comey acted improperly and hurt Clinton's campaign, he actually helped her by absolving her. And in the meantime, you have Strzok out here today saying, oh, I didn't reveal any of this information which could have been damaging to Trump's campaign. And what it reveals is that the FBI is just really trying to save face as hard as possible.
Yeah, ultimately, the FBI wants to protect the FBI as an institution. I mean, the Democrats are also making the case that James Comey, by reopening or announcing the reopening of the Clinton email server investigation 11 days before the election, did create a dark cloud over Clinton and Clinton's trustworthiness. That was after the original press conference back in July 2016, where Comey had said, not grossly negligent criminal, instead extremely careless, just a bad judgment. But nonetheless, I don't think we're learning anything from this hearing.
Nothing. I mean, very, very little. Minimal information. Strzok is just really putting his foot down and not giving anything that might harm the FBI's credibility.
This is a story that is only going to get worse and more interesting We were joined in studio by Alex Rubenstein. He is the Sputnik News analyst and journalist who also tweets at Real Alex Ruby. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The annual summit of NATO heads of state ended yesterday with President Trump saying that member countries had agreed to increase their defense spending, perhaps even to double it. But French President Emmanuel Macron was quick to say that the president's statement was untrue. Meanwhile, Trump reiterated as he was boarding Air Force One that he is, quote, a very stable genius, unquote. We are joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Alexander, welcome back.
Delighted to be back.
So, Alexander, what should we make of this assertion by President Trump that NATO member states have agreed to increase their defense spending to as much as 4%, even though something like three of them are as high as 2%? And then Macron and others deny that any such agreement ever was made.
Well, I mean, the answer is that there is no such commitment. I mean, Donald Trump is saying, and not for the first time, something which just flatly isn't the case. The communique contains no such commitment. It has the old historic commitment of 2% of GDP defense spending, which goes back to 2014, and which, to be clear, has been a guideline for much longer than that. I mean, that's always been roughly what NATO member states were supposed to be spending. Very few of them actually ever have reached that sort of level, apart, of course, from the US. And I don't really think anything as much is going to change, because Donald Trump came along, he huffed and puffed. He made all sorts of threats. There's some talk that he actually said that the U.S. would quit NATO unless they all came up to 2%. He then said that they should really go up to 4%. And in fact, it doesn't seem as if anything actually has changed, and there don't seem to be any very definite commitments made.
Well, let's make it 8%. Let's just keep doubling. What the heck?
Indeed. I mean, it's very typical Donald Trump. I mean, he comes along, he makes all, I mean, the 4% target that he's talking about is unrealistic. There is no possibility at a time of austerity in Europe and with many people in Europe being very hostile to further increases in defense spending, which will lead to cutbacks in other areas, social areas where people are really affected and where they're concerned. There's no possibility of 4% happening. So, I mean, you spoke of it as a sort of Tony Soprano act, I think. You're absolutely right. That's what it was. It was a sort of blackmail attempt to make the NATO partners agree to this, to increase spending. And it's just not going to happen. And I think that the person who's going to look foolish out of it at the end of the day is Donald Trump.
If the NATO members, if the 28 NATO members actually increase their defense spending up to 2%, which they don't want to do because, one, there's not really a threat. I mean, and this increased spending isn't going to be sending like British, French, and German soldiers to stand at the Russian border, you know, protecting against the onslaught. It's really going to go to the military-industrial complex, the big defense contractors. But, you know, like England spends maybe 1% of its budget on military, and people have so many unmet needs in England. I mean, the last thing people want to do is actually spend more money for weapons, more money for missiles, more money for bombs. And yet we have all the, you know, it's so weird. I have to say it's bizarre, Alexander. Here in the United States, people who were traditionally like the liberal Democrats complaining, whining, screaming, shrieking that Donald Trump is undermining our allies by demanding that they spend more, and then not remembering that it was Barack Obama who finally took the 2% guideline and forced it into an actual memorandum that all of the entities signed. The Washington Post, for instance, says Donald Trump is haranguing the NATO members because he has the notion that they must spend 2% of their military budget. Well, the 2% notion came from Barack Obama in terms of the actual memoranda. Everything is turned up upside down. Instead of people focusing on why does NATO exist? 27 years after the fall of the Soviet Union, almost three decades after the end of the Warsaw Pact, which was formed 6 years after NATO was formed, the military alliance of the USSR and the socialist bloc nations of Eastern and Central Europe. And now we have NATO in Afghanistan. That's not the North Atlantic. Bombing Libya, not the North Atlantic. Of course, destroying Yugoslavia in the center part of Europe. I mean, why not abolish it?
Well, indeed. And can I just make a further point? You talk about the complete unreality and illogic of all of this. I mean, let's just unpack what Donald Trump is saying. He is complaining that the Europeans are not spending enough on defense, and he wants them to increase defense spending even further. But that's not to compensate for any reductions in U.S. defense spending, because, of course, what Donald Trump is doing is he's increasing U.S. defense spending. So we're going to have a situation where the U.S. increases defense spending. He's putting pressure on the Europeans to increase defense spending even further. And who exactly are they all going to be fighting? Well, they're not going to be fighting Russia, because realistically, that doesn't seem to be the agenda at the moment. Donald Trump is going to be meeting with Putin very soon, and there's talk about improving relations. So what is this all for? Why does NATO exist? Why is the U.S. cranking up spending? Why are the Europeans having their arms twisted to increase spending even more? None of it makes any real sense. And again, one has to look, I think, at the people who are paying the bills for Donald Trump's election campaigns and all those sort of things. And I'm afraid it comes back to the arms companies. And it seems to me that ultimately this is what NATO has now become. It's become this great racket whereby some people in the United States and a few people in Europe are doing very well for themselves, a NATO headquarters in all sorts of positions, and all sorts of businesses and companies are doing extremely well, filling out these massive arms contracts, which have no real logic behind them.
You know, John, the old cliche, patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels. We have a lot of scoundrels. Alexander is referring to some of them. The people who are actually making huge amounts of money to build weapons and bombs. And weapons of military weapons are a commodity of a particular type. It's not like a house. It's not like your car. It's not like clothes. It's not like food. Human beings can't actually avail themselves of these commodities. They don't circulate as normal commodities do. They can only be used to bomb and destroy, to be used in war, and then to be replenished. They don't circulate. In that way, all defense spending is waste, because it actually contributes nothing to society. It's waste spending. It's like taking money and pouring it down a toilet. There might be a few thousand defense workers who have jobs, but it's a very capital-intensive business. It's not labor-intensive. It's not like building highways or high-speed trains or bridges. So we have all of this money being drained out of the national budget, and the people are told there's no money for housing or healthcare or the things that you actually need or we actually need, the people actually need. The last refuge of scoundrels, because patriotism now equates with war spending. You know, that's what this so-called, it's not love of country in the abstract, it's love of weapons and weapons of mass destruction, even.
And it's forced on American society too. Look at any NFL football game, and you can't have a football game without the most enormous flag you've ever seen on the field, and a flyover by Air Force jets, and some random color guard marching out there with flags, and everybody has to stand for the national anthem. And at baseball games, you have to stand for God Bless America. It's a forced kind of fake patriotism where the Pentagon actually pays sports teams to allow them to do those things.
Indeed.
It's the propagandization of the American people.
I don't stand up myself, Alexander, but there is a lot of social pressure when you don't. Anyway, go ahead.
Yes, well, I mean, I think if I could just come back to your point about economies, I mean, this has been studied many, many times. And, of course, the academic consensus is that high defense spending over time weakens economies. I mean, industries that should be producing civilian goods produce military goods, so they're not competing with other countries that are producing civilian goods. One of the reasons the United States runs a big trade deficit on its goods, something which Donald Trump is supposed to be concerned about, is because its factories, instead of competing with civilian factories in other places, are churning out at huge cost weapons. One of the reasons the United States does not have the good infrastructure it should have is because, as I said, so much of the U.S. budget now is tied up with spending on weapons. So one of the reasons why U.S. students have to pay such a huge amount on college fees and have to get into such heavy debt is because the United States is spending money on weapons. If the U.S. wasn't spending to the extent it is spending on its weapons, its economy would be very much stronger. And, of course, we would also be, to be frank, a much more equal society, because that is another thing we find out from studies of countries which spend very heavily on defense spending, is that, of course, it goes disproportionately to few people as opposed to the many. The benefits do. So they weaken economies. But Donald Trump doesn't seem to see that. He sees heavy defense spending as somehow a virility symbol for the United States. He's surrounded, I think, as I said, by people who see this as a good opportunity for themselves to make money. And as you absolutely rightly say, unfortunately, I think this is perhaps more true in the U.S. than it is in Europe. But I think in the U.S. especially, high defense spending has become a feature of a very great degree of militarization of political discourse and of society. I mean, when I watch American TV programs and indeed American films now, the extent to which the military is omnipresent in all of these is, in fact, frankly, very worrying.
We're going to have to leave it there, Alexander. We were joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll take a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Israel struck three Syrian government targets overnight after an unarmed Syrian drone strayed over Israeli territory. The Syrian media reported that there was material damage, but there were no casualties. We're joined from the United Kingdom by Ambassador Peter Ford. He's the former British ambassador to Syria. Welcome back, Ambassador.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Tell us how important this is. I mean, these kinds of things happen every once in a while. The key is to not allow them to escalate. It doesn't appear, at least in the first 12 or so hours after the incident, that it is escalating. What do you think about it?
I don't think we're going to see any major escalation. I think this was a bit of a tit for tat. There are several different possible explanations. One is that it was an errant drone that precipitated the Israeli counter-offensive. But more likely, it was either literally a trial balloon by Hezbollah or the Syrian army to test the Israeli defenses, or, and I think I favor this explanation, it was a demonstration to the Israelis that the Syrian side have the capability to deliver payloads 10 kilometers into Israel if Israel thought that it was going to bully Syria into expelling its Iranian allies.
That's an important point, actually.
Peter Ford is our guest. Ambassador Ford was the ambassador from the UK to Syria. At the same time, or shortly thereafter, today and later, Vladimir Putin is also meeting with the Israeli leadership, also meeting with the Iranian leadership. Where do you think Russia lands on this? Of course, Russia has a strategic alliance with the Syrian government. The Iranian government also has what they consider to be a strategic relationship with the Syrian government, not necessarily the same sort of strategic relationship that Russia has. And at the same time, Russia is trying to and has, in fact, improved relationship with the Netanyahu government in Israel. So where do you think Russia lands here?
Well, I think there's an attempt by Trump to try to extract some cessions from the Russian-Syrian side in return for the withdrawal of U.S. Forces from Syria, those several thousand troops who are mainly in north-central and northeast Syria. But he's playing a very weak hand, I believe. Those troops are not enough to make any big difference to the strategic equation. They don't represent an existential threat to the Syrian government. In fact, in a sense, those troops are hostages, because if ever there is a real conflict, they will be first in line to get retaliated against. So I don't think that Donald Trump will succeed in leveraging his assets in Syria against a Russian pressure on Iran to leave. Anyway, I don't think that even if the Russians tried, they would be able to lever Iran out of Syria. The Syrian government wants the Iranians to stay, and I don't think the Russians have the wherewithal or the desire to remove the Iranians. No, this so-called big deal is not going to work, not in the form anyway that the Israelis have been dreaming about.
You know, it seems to me also that this is an indication of a failure of policy, at least on the part of the United States, where we've got a presence there. We're obviously working closely with the Israelis. We like to think that we're working with the Turks and with the Syrian Kurds. But at the end of the day, there's really no well-thought-out long-term policy for what exactly it is we're trying to accomplish there, other than that vague regime change that people talk about every once in a while. And then we have situations like this where there's a tit-for-tat strike. Your drone flies over the other guy's territory, and then the other guy launches a couple of rockets. And that goes on. It can go on for years and years. And then next thing you know, a decade has passed and you still have a troop presence in this country and nothing's changed.
And maybe that is by design. That's purposeful, in fact, on the part of the U.S. Ambassador Ford, I'm looking at the Council on Foreign Relations, at one time the think tank in the U.S. foreign policy establishment. Not so much anymore, but still important. But their articles doesn't make them not rubbish either, but I'm looking at one right today, headline, "Don't Get Out of Syria. Assad's victory will only lead to more chaos." And it's got this position. This is the front page of Foreign Affairs saying, "Don't get out of Syria." On all questions, I mean, on all fronts here, that's a remarkable position for this entity or anyone to take regarding the U.S. presence, but maybe it reflects a position inside the U.S. Washington establishment. Don't get out of Syria. U.S. should stay in Syria forever. Go ahead.
Yeah, this article stands truth on its head. There is no way that Syria can be fully stabilized as long as the U.S. remains present in 30% of Syria in the north-central parts and the northeast. That whole part of Syria, in fact, is being destabilized. The Americans are repeating the same mistakes in that area that they made in Iraq, in place of the Shia, who were effectively put in to rule over the Sunni villages. You have the Kurds of the SDF, the U.S. Proxy force, who are now meeting problems with the Sunni Arab villagers in that territory. And those are precisely the conditions that gave rise to the emergence of ISIS. That's the first point. Secondly, as long as the U.S. forces are there, that prevents the central government from reasserting itself over the whole country. And ISIS can move back and forth across the dividing line of these two components of Syrian territory. No, I'm afraid the Council on Foreign Relations is a parody of what it used to be. I notice it's repeating their position as Senator Lindsey Graham, who is a uber hawk with a track record of getting everything wrong.
Ambassador Peter Ford is our guest. Ambassador Ford was the UK ambassador to Syria. You know, I'm glad you mentioned about the fundamental reason that an organization like ISIS came into existence. And again, the Council on Foreign Relations does not reflect it. None of the U.S. media reflects what the U.S. responsibility here is. What happened to Iraq? And what happened to the Sunni forces that constituted a big core, not the exclusive core, but a big core of the Ba'athist party in the Ba'athist state infrastructure? What happened to them after the invasion? It says a lot about what actually caused the rise of ISIS. ISIS was not simply like dropped from the skies, some maniacal, devilish force that suddenly arrived. It was its birthright was based on conditions caused by the United States. Again, even though this should be known by everybody, actually in America, very few people think about this or know about it at this point, here 15 years after the invasion of Iraq.
Well, let's recall that when the U.S. forces moved into Iraq to topple Saddam, there was no ISIS. It came about as a direct result of the toppling of Saddam and the weakening of the central authority, the dismantling of the Ba'athist apparatus of state, and the installing, after a hiatus in its place, of a Shia-dominated government, which was obviously anathema to the Sunni component of the population. And it was this having Shia overlords foisted on them that helped to spawn ISIS. And that is why ISIS did what they did and spread over took control of more than a third of Iraq and a big slice of Syria. And these are precisely the same conditions which are being recreated by the U.S. hanging on beyond its welcome in northern Syria. Exactly the same. History is repeating itself.
Yeah, and that's why people like this Jennifer Caffarella from the Oregon of the Council on Foreign Relations have it exactly wrong. I mean, 100% wrong. It's not that the U.S. is contributing to the stability in Syria, or can.
On the contrary.
It's on the contrary. Anyway.
We were joined from the United Kingdom by Ambassador Peter Ford. Ambassador Ford is the former British ambassador to Syria. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Monsanto is in court this week because a California landscaper has terminal cancer after using Monsanto's Roundup weed killer for decades. And Monsanto covered up evidence that Roundup is carcinogenic. We're joined from Virginia by Alexis Baden-Meyer, the political director for Organic Consumers Alliance. Alexis, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Alexis, when I was in Afghanistan last time, there was a lot of talk about using Roundup to kill the poppy crop. And the generals objected to this, saying that Roundup was carcinogenic and would cause birth defects. Well, they're not botanists. They're military leaders. And even they knew that Roundup was carcinogenic. So how in the world did Monsanto get away with this for so long? And it's only now that the courts are hearing that this stuff is poison and it kills people.
Well, we have to remember, we're living in the United States of America, where this corporation has tons of power over our elected officials, over the agencies that are supposed to protect human health and the environment. So even though the world is aware of this and the World Health Organization with its cancer panel and its scientists have weighed in and let the public know that Roundup is carcinogenic, in the United States, it's very, very difficult to get this point across.
Alexis, when we're looking at the media reports, these are hundreds of lawsuits against Monsanto.
That's right.
Hundreds. Now, we know in the past that there were lawsuits against the tobacco companies. They led ultimately to major injunctive relief, real reforms. Not enough, certainly. But is this the kind of legal action that could lead to that kind of an outcome? And also, why not combine these lawsuits into some sort of mega lawsuit? What's the dynamic? What's the process here?
Well, we have lawsuits in federal court as well as state court. And in fact, there are probably about 5,000 of them across the country. And some of them are being combined where it's possible to do so. So the legal case that's happening in San Francisco right now is multi-district litigation. So they've put together as many of the federal lawsuits as possible. And the state courts are closely watching that federal case happening now in San Francisco. So that will set the tone. And so far, that lawsuit is going okay. Not all of the plaintiff's expert witnesses were allowed to testify, but the judge allowed four of them and made a conclusion that based on their testimony, a reasonable jury could confirm that Monsanto's Roundup has caused the cancer. They have to now make it specific to the people who are claiming to have gotten cancer from exposure to Roundup. But I think that I'm very hopeful that this case is going to make a huge impact. And maybe there are some upsides to Bayer having bought Monsanto. Now, I wouldn't say that Bayer has any moral legitimacy that, you know, obviously, it's doing the same thing Monsanto has always done. Bayer happens to be the biggest seller of the insecticides that kill bees, for instance. And they've partnered with Monsanto to put genetically modified crops along with these bee-killing insecticides. So they're in cahoots, and they have the same sort of moral compass. But they may see this recent acquisition and the baggage that comes with this company in terms of these lawsuits and make some good decisions from a business perspective. Unfortunately, not a moral perspective, but I'm very hopeful that this lawsuit will have a big impact.
Alexis, I'm looking at your website, and again, for our audience, you can go to the website. It's organicconsumers.org. It's a wonderful website. It's packed full of content. There are ways for people to learn about the issue. There's also ways for people to get involved and ways for people to support Organic Consumers Association. But the article that I'm looking at is a campaign called that you've initiated called Millions Against Monsanto. And I think this is important because in addition to these 500 plus legal actions that are going to be in the courts, you're obviously going also to society writ large, to the public, to the people. This campaign has been going on since the mid-1990s, so more than 20 years old. Talk about what Millions Against Monsanto campaign is and what people can do if they wanted to get involved with it.
Thank you. Well, that campaign has been our most popular campaign of all time. And I think the sad truth around that is that so many people are experiencing health problems. And they start to do some internet research. They look into, say, you're having digestive issues. Well, what might be causing that? That might be due to the GMOs and the insecticides and pesticides that have really hit our diet hard since the late 1990s when these crops first started on the market. So since then, that's when Monsanto's Roundup became the top-selling herbicide and probably human-made chemical of all time. And now we've been exposed to that one substance, that one dangerous chemical, more than any other that we've come up with as human beings on the planet. So we're all impacted by it. And the science has slowly been building. We don't do a lot of public research in the United States. And actually, frankly, most other countries don't do a great job on public research into toxic chemicals. So it's taken a long time for the science to build up. But now we know a lot more about the ways that it causes cancer, especially non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the way it impacts our gut bacteria, and how genetically modified organisms might be triggering allergic reactions and autoimmune responses in our bodies because it's being confronted with this unknown protein that we've never before digested. So when people start learning a bit about that, they get really pissed off. Because usually it's moms with small kids who have these health problems. We're seeing horrible rates of autism, learning disabilities, various things that are probably related to the onslaught of chemicals, especially agricultural chemicals and pesticides. So people, you know, when you're a corporation that crosses the moms trying to keep their kids healthy, you're in big trouble. And this campaign started a while back, but it really was advanced by other organizations like the March Against Monsanto, which came out strong during the Obama administration when most progressives were taking a break, you know, thinking that everything is okay with things in Washington. But we knew that while Michelle Obama was planting an organic garden, Barack Obama was, his agencies were approving GMOs that the Bush administration hadn't been able to get approved because they were more sloppy, and the Bush administration didn't dot their I's and cross their T's, but the Obama administration did and managed to do the things that the courts required and get lots of new GMOs onto the market. Some GMOs that aren't even intended for human consumption, but nevertheless will contaminate our food supply, like GMOs designed to be turned into ethanol. So people got really mad during that time, and this campaign went wild. And of course, this was at the same time that the Occupy movement was coming up. And so people had a greater awareness of corporate power and how it influences our political system. So I think all of these things have converged to strengthen the food movement, and it's still not especially mainstream among even progressive Democrats. I've been looking at what the Progressive Caucus is doing in Congress, and they're not taking on these food issues, and many of the members of the Progressive Caucus even, and certainly the leadership of the Democratic Party, they don't get these issues. They don't understand why it's so important to your average person to have a safe food supply.
We're speaking with Alexis Baden-Meyer. She's the political director for Organic Consumers Alliance. Alexis, what can our listeners use instead of a toxic chemical like Roundup that is effective and safe for the environment?
Well, there are a number of things that are allowed for use in organic. So a good database of that is the Organic Materials Review Institute. And there you can see all of the things that are used for weed control or insect control by organic farmers. And certainly we've got, you can look up a YouTube video for how to make your own herbicide out of safe cleaning products, you know, like vinegar and things that you would have in your cupboard that would be safe for food use. You can also make herbicides out of common household ingredients. So there are definitely, ways large and small to get these insecticides and pesticides and GMOs out of our food supply. It's definitely the only necessity is for these companies to keep making money. That's what makes this continue. So, but there are obviously lots of alternatives. You can go to Walmart and Costco and buy organic food now. And we've seen through studies that the United Nations has done that when you're talking about smallholder farmers around the world and what's going to increase yields in the countries where it matters most, and it's the organic and agroecological methods, because those are knowledge-based. They don't require the expensive inputs that set farmers back.
Alexis, we only have about 90 seconds left. I'm also looking at your website again, Organic Consumers. One of the really interesting pieces here is called Modern Agriculture is Working to Protect Our Planet. And it's about an alternative way of growing food that instead of devastating the environment and devastating us, devastating the public, poisoning us, as happens with Monsanto and all of these industrial chemicals, It's a five-step program for agriculture. I won't go over it because we don't have the time. But there are alternatives. There are now holistic alternatives. There's another way. This is really about people and decisions. It's not inevitable. In a way that we can still feed an ever-growing population on the planet. Go ahead.
That's right. We've mostly talked about how organic agriculture doesn't have the bad things that industrial agriculture has. But organic agriculture also has tremendous benefits for our ecosystem beyond what, being toxic-free. So, for instance, soil. Soil is what filters our water and provides clean water in our reservoirs. Soil also captures carbon from the atmosphere. So if we do take a large-scale adoption of organic agriculture, we're going to be solving many more problems than just getting toxins out of our food.
That was the voice of Alexis Baden-Meyer, the political director for Organic Consumers Alliance. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter @LoudClearRadio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear.